between Ukraine and Russia and the United States and NATO. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
Seven FM and streaming online at KBOO.FM.
The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. For more information, email newsdirector@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Pfizer seeks FDA approval for its COVID-19 vaccine in children 6 months to 5 years old. The Washington State Attorney General sues a COVID-19 testing company over faked tests, and two right-wing Proud Boy members are indicted for violence during a 2021 rally in Portland. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 1st, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Pharmaceutical company Pfizer, along with its partner BioNTech, asked the Food and Drug Administration on Tuesday to expand the use of its COVID vaccine to children ages 6 months to 5 years old. The application included data on the safety and effectiveness of the two-dose vaccine, and the company said it plans on submitting data on a booster dose in the coming months. The company added that the third dose will be considered part of the primary vaccination series. The dosage for the age group is also lower at 3 micrograms. Compare that to the 10 microgram doses given to kids age 5 to 11 and the 30 microgram doses given to everyone age 12 and up. The company said Tuesday that there was no safety concerns reported related to the first two doses. The FDA will review the data submitted by Pfizer and could grant emergency use authorization for the age group by the end of February. The FDA's advisory group, the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, is scheduled to meet on February 15th to offer guidance on the pediatric doses. Children under 5 are the only group in the U.S. currently ineligible to receive a COVID vaccine. While the disease is not as severe in children as it is in adults, there are kids in this age group who have been hospitalized and some have even died. A survey released Tuesday from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 3 in 10 parents of children under 5 say they will get their kid vaccinated right away once a vaccine is authorized for the age group. According to health officials, Oregon still hasn't hit its projected peak of hospitalizations due to the Omicron wave. The latest forecast from the Oregon Health and Science University projects a peak of 1,200 statewide hospitalizations on February 6th. That's several days later and substantially lower than previous estimates. The Oregon Health Authority reported 1,099 people hospitalized on Monday, including 187 patients in intensive care units. Dr. Peter Graven is the director of the OHSU Office of Advanced Analytics. Dr. Graven said, quote, "The current number of hospitalized patients in Oregon is at near record levels. Hospitals have very little space right now to handle new cases of COVID-19 on top of what they're already dealing with. Our hospitals and healthcare workers remain under severe strain," end quote. Graven added that the hospitalization rate should start to go down after Oregon passes the peak in another week. He said this is because at that point the virus will be finding fewer and fewer Oregonians who are susceptible to severe infection. Statewide daily case rates appear to have peaked on January 20th and are now declining, although they remain far higher than at any point in the pandemic prior to Omicron. COVID cases fell 22% in Oregon in the past week. However, state epidemiologist Dr. Dean Seidlinger cautioned that the rest of the state tends to lag behind the Portland metro area in terms of both cases and hospitalization trends, so some areas could still see rising cases even as Portland's begins to recede. Doctors and state health officials continue to urge Oregonians to take COVID precautions, including wearing masks and getting booster shots. Unfortunately, Oregon fell short of Governor Kate Brown's goal to get COVID booster shots in the arms of 1 million more Oregonians by the end of January. The state administered boosters to about 500,000 people, just halfway to its goal. Oregon's legislature convened on Tuesday, beginning a 35-day short session expected to cover pandemic recovery, worker protections, and the state's mental health system, and more. The legislative session held Tuesday was the first in 10 years without former House Speaker Tina Kotek. Kotek stepped down last month to run for governor of Oregon. The Oregon House of Representatives elected Representative Dan Rayfield, a Democrat from Corvallis, to serve as Speaker of the House. Rayfield was broadly elected to win the speakership and had already begun to move his belongings into the large office behind the chamber prior to the vote. Republicans put forward their caucus leader, Representative Vicky Breese Iverson of Prineville, for the position. Also up for consideration was Representative Janelle Bynum, the Happy Valley Democrat who went up against Rayfield for her party's nomination last month. Rayfield won the contest with 32 votes, one more than necessary to become Speaker. Also on Tuesday, Travis Nelson was sworn in to fill Kotek's House position for District 44. Nelson is the first Black openly LGBTQ plus man to serve in the Oregon legislature. Already Tuesday, signs of potential disagreement emerged in the House. Several Republicans spoke out against a Democratic bill, House Bill 4002, that would grant overtime pay to farm workers, a step Republicans say will put small farms out of business. Lawmakers also argued about masking requirements. Several Republicans rose to complain about the state's rules, among the strictest in the country, requiring Oregonians to wear masks while inside public spaces. The comments prompted a response from Representative Lisa Reynolds, a Portland Democrat and pediatrician, who pointed out that the number of Oregon children hospitalized with COVID-19 recently reached an all-time high. Reynolds added, quote, "I am tired of the minimization of this deadly disease," end quote. The state of Washington filed a lawsuit against an Illinois-based coronavirus testing company on Tuesday, alleging that the firm faked test results, lied to customers, and stored samples in garbage bags instead of properly refrigerating them. The lawsuit against the Center for COVID Control was filed in King County Superior Court. The company is based outside Chicago and operates about 300 pop-up testing sites across the country. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson said in a statement, quote, "These sham testing centers threaten the health and safety of our communities. They must be held accountable." The company operated 13 testing sites in Washington, but only had a license for one site in Yakima and not for the 12 other sites. They advertised that they could provide COVID test results within 15 minutes for a rapid antigen test or 48 hours for a PCR test. Court papers say that the company was aware it could not actually process tests at this rate. Ferguson added, quote, "Former employees reported that the company was receiving between 8,000 and 10,000 tests per day, and data entry staff could not keep up. So employees stored tests in garbage bags and stashed them in their offices, then backdated them so that old samples would still be processed. The Center for COVID Control, which has collected more than 400,000 samples nationwide, temporarily shut down in January amid cascading complaints about its business practices, including an investigation here in Oregon by the State Department of Justice. Healthcare workers in Washington state aren't immune to the industry burnout happening across the country. Workers hope legislation introduced in Olympia this session can alleviate the burden on healthcare providers. Emily Scott has more on the story.
A majority of Washington healthcare workers report feeling burned out in the pandemic, according to the latest survey. Legislation aims to address their concerns by ensuring safe staffing levels, as well as rest and meal breaks. Companion bills in the State House and Senate create staffing ratios for different departments within a hospital. They also repeal certain exemptions from overtime and rest break requirements, holding hospital administrators accountable with potential fines. State Senator June Robinson of Snohomish County, sponsoring the Senate bill, says it protects both staff and patients.
It's just heartbreaking to think about them feeling horrible because they weren't able to provide the care they wanted to, but it's also horrifying to think about patients. They are not getting the care that they need because of a lack of appropriate staffing.
Hospital administrators point to the nationwide shortage of healthcare workers as a reason for staffing issues. The Senate bill received a Monday hearing in the Labor, Commerce, and Tribal Affairs Committee. The House bill survived the Labor and Workplace Standards Committee and now heads to Appropriations. Julia Barcott, a registered nurse at Astrea Toppenish, says burnout due to work overload has long been an issue in the healthcare system and was only exacerbated by the pandemic. Barcott says it's important to consider why people are leaving the profession.
There's actually a shortage of healthcare workers willing to work under these conditions. In Washington state, we have over 100,000 registered nurses. Only 60,000 are working. Many of those have chosen to do something else because the working conditions are so atrocious.
According to a December poll of Washington healthcare union members, 49% said they're likely to leave the profession in the next few years, citing staffing issues as one of the main reasons. This is Emily Scott reporting.
Two members of the right-wing group, the Proud Boys, who participated in an August 22, 2021 rally in Portland's Park Rose neighborhood, have been indicted for several acts of violence during the event. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Two members of the right-wing Proud Boys organization were indicted for several acts of violence they committed in Portland. The indictments handed down in December were based on their participation in an August 22nd rally in Portland Park Rose. They were unsealed on January 31st of this year after a judge arraigned both members in Multnomah County City Court. Tusitala Tiny Tuasi was charged with 6 counts of assault and 2 counts each of unlawful use of a weapon, rioting, and criminal mischief. Miles Furrow, allegedly photographed on August 22nd beating a man in a pickup truck, was charged with 6 counts of assault, 1 count of unlawful use of a weapon, and 1 count of rioting. The August 22nd rally was held to mark the anniversary of a previous rally, which took place the year before. Both turned violent as Proud Boys and anti-fascist counter-demonstrators faced off. In both cases, police presence was minimal. In 2020, the Portland Police Bureau said it was too short-staffed to intervene, and in 2021, the Bureau said it would investigate criminal activities after the fact. Criminal charges related to the August rally were dismissed for a third individual. The district attorney's office did not comment on why the charges were dropped. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Cascade Festival of African Films starting this Friday. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 41. Today in history, in 1884, the first portion of the Oxford English Dictionary, considered the most comprehensive and accurate dictionary of the English language, is published. Today, the OED is the definitive authority on the meaning, pronunciation, and history of over 500,000 English words, past and present. The quote of the day is from American writer, inventor, and U.S. founding father Benjamin Franklin, who served as the first U.S. Postmaster General. Franklin wrote in his yearly publication, The Poor Richard's Almanac, quote, "Either write something worth reading or do something worth writing." Florida's new election law is on trial. President Joe Biden makes moves to secure energy in Eastern Europe, and some world leaders weigh in on controversies over COVID-19 policies. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We really can't afford to not have one step of what we do in order to vote to be taken away from us.
As a trial over Florida's 2021 voting law began, NAACP Florida President Adora Nwezi argued the new measures discriminate against minorities, people with disabilities, and older voters. The law restricts mail-in ballots, drop boxes, and third-party voter registration groups. Supporters argue reforms are needed to prevent election fraud. President Joe Biden wants to designate Qatar, the world's second-largest producer of liquefied natural gas, as a major non-NATO ally. Biden and Qatar's leaders are discussing a European energy contingency plan in case Russia invades Ukraine. Senator Joe Manchin defended Biden's promise to nominate the first black woman to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court.
This is far beyond time, far beyond time. It's time to do it.
The West Virginia Democrat said he hopes to quickly confirm a successor for retiring Justice Stephen Breyer. First Lady Jill Biden encouraged spouses of the nation's governors to work together on issues that transcend politics.
Why talk to people who will never agree with you? And the answer is, I am their First Lady too.
After a report revealed that at least a dozen Downing Street parties were held breaching pandemic lockdown rules, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson apologized Monday.
We ask people across this country to make the most extraordinary sacrifices, not to meet loved ones, not to visit relatives before they died. And I understand the anger that people feel.
Johnson is facing calls to resign. And in Canada, thousands of truck drivers continued protests in Ottawa against COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who is isolated after testing positive for the virus, condemned conservatives who support the protest.
This is a moment for responsible leaders to think carefully about where they stand and who they stand with.
Back here in the States, California Governor Gavin Newsom responded to his critics after a photo emerged of him maskless at an NFL playoff game.
I was trying to be gracious and took the mask off for a brief second.
A growing list of states are calling for a constitutional convention. Backers want new amendments to impose fiscal restraints on Congress, limit federal power, and set term limits for federal officials, arguing Article 5 was written for states to respond should the federal government overstep its powers. But Vicki Harrison with Common Cause notes it doesn't include guardrails, leaving the Constitution vulnerable to unpredictable changes.
Education or environmental rights or gun rights, no matter what you care about in the Constitution, if we called an Article 5 convention, it's up for grabs.
So far, 17 of the necessary 34 states to call a constitutional convention that passed resolutions in favor. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources will hold a public hearing on Line 5. Pueblo leaders in New Mexico seek protection of petroglyphs near Santa Fe, and a tribal-led coalition supports the creation of a monument near Searchlight, Nevada. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal groups are gearing up to voice concerns over the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources draft environmental review of Enbridge's Line 5 relocation project. The DNR is holding a public hearing virtually Wednesday on the review. Since its release in December, tribes and tribal groups have been critical of the review of the project to reroute the oil pipeline across northern Wisconsin. The Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission and tribes say the review is flawed and are raising concerns about oil spills. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior has filed a lawsuit challenging the reroute to protect watershed. Supporters of the project point to jobs and an economic boost. Comments on the draft will be taken through March 4th. The Clark County Commission is expected to consider a resolution Tuesday on the creation of a national monument outside of Searchlight, Nevada. As Suzanne Potter reports, tribes are among those in support of protecting the area.
An indigenous-led coalition has been working to establish the 450,000-acre monument since the 1990s. A Swedish wind power company has made an application to build in the area, which has heightened the pressure to move forward on the monument. Craig Bakurjian, campaign manager for the Avikwame Coalition, says the tribes consider the area to be of utmost importance because to them it is hallowed ground.
It is the site of creation for the Mojave people. The Fort Mojave Indian tribe view it as one of their most sacred spaces, and 10 other human-speaking tribes view that as a sacred spot.
The Boulder City Council and the town advisory boards of Searchlight and Laughlin, plus the Laughlin Tourism Commission and Chamber of Commerce, have already declared their support. Congresswomen Dina Titus and Susie Lee are working on legislation to be introduced later this year. Bakurjian says the idea of a new monument also is supported by a majority of Nevadans.
A recent poll found that 70% of Nevadans support the designation of Avikwame as a national monument and ensure that those spaces are not sold off to corporations.
In the same poll, 39% of Nevadans say it's important for officials to prioritize the protection of public lands. The coalition says hikers and off-roaders would still be able to use parts of the monument land. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Pueblo leaders in New Mexico are calling for the protection of petroglyphs west of Santa Fe, which were recently vandalized. The All Pueblo Council of Governors say the area has suffered from years of mismanagement between federal, state, and private oversight, which has led to harm. They're calling for a multi-agency investigation, consultation with tribes, and for action to protect and preserve the area. In January, the Bureau of Land Management found vandalism at the La Cieneguilla petroglyphs, which are up to 8,000 years old. 10 were defaced with graffiti. The BLM is seeking information from the public. People who damage cultural sites may be charged with a felony, face prison time, and thousands of dollars in fines. A bill in California requiring state agencies to enhance cooperation between tribes and state and local governments was approved by the state assembly. The measure requiring training of state agencies on tribal government consultation was approved Monday by the assembly with a vote of 70-0. Assembly member James Ramos introduced the bill. He says there's often confusion when local and state agencies interact with tribes, including on issues of sovereignty and jurisdiction. Ramos says this can have an impact during emergencies such as wildfires, earthquakes, or amid the pandemic. The measure also enhances the consultation system with the executive branch of the state. The bill has the support of a number of tribes and now moves to the state Senate for consideration. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. is lagging in the race to build an electric vehicle battery industry. Much of the current supply is controlled by China. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As countries work to cut carbon pollution, the demand for electric vehicles and the batteries they run on is expected to skyrocket. Producing EV batteries in the U.S. could help create domestic jobs and spur economic growth. But for the U.S. to be a major player in the industry, experts say the country needs to get busy fast. China controls much of the current EV battery supply chain, including mining for raw materials, processing those materials, and manufacturing the finished batteries.
So it's very important that we reduce our dependency on foreign nations for our own sovereignty's sake.
Bob Gallion is a battery expert and former chief technology officer of one of the world's largest battery makers, a Chinese company called CATL. He says the U.S. should grow its industry by focusing on innovation, not just replicating the battery manufacturing process that exists elsewhere.
It is clear that there may be other battery technologies that will come in and displace some of the typical lithium batteries in the applications that we see today.
So new technologies could help the U.S. create its own niche in the industry while building a clean transportation future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A new study from Stanford University finds that gas stoves in home kitchens leak the same amount of greenhouse gases each year as 500,000 cars, making them a significant contributor to climate change. Mike Clifford has the story.
Gas stoves in home kitchens are leaking a lot more methane gas than previously known,
which has implications for the fight against climate change. According to a new study, it comes from Stanford University. Researchers found in the U.S. each year, gas stoves emit 2.6 million tons of methane, which is the same amount of greenhouse gas as 500,000 cars. Eric LaBelle, a senior scientist at the nonprofit PSE Energy Oakland, is a study co-author.
Over about 20 years, the total climate impact of the same weight of methane gas is 86 times more than the same weight of carbon dioxide. So methane leaks are very important, even small leaks.
Multiple cities in California, including Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco, have banned gas ranges in new construction.
A climate change-driven decrease in annual snowpack around the globe is making it harder to hold winter sports competitions. This includes the 2022 Winter Olympics, which opens this Friday in Beijing, China. Mark Richardson has more.
The 2020 Olympic Games are scheduled to open in Beijing later this week, but new research shows that unless world leaders make significant progress toward mitigating climate change, they could be the last Winter Games. The report finds in most parts of the world, including Colorado and the American West, winter sports venues say the natural snowfalls they depend on to operate are no longer reliable. The Beijing Games will be the first ever produced with 100% artificial snow. Maddie Orr, founder of the Global Sports Ecology Group, says the warming climate presents a major obstacle for winter sports.
What we're starting to see is snow is going away. So it's going to be a challenge moving forward to identify those places where you're going to have a snow-sure condition to host an event without relying extensively on artificial snow.
A sports ecology group, Save Our Winters report out this week, warns that shifting climate patterns in Colorado and around the world are producing an ever-shrinking snowpack, which has decreased by a total of 35 inches since the 1970s. While man-made snow can be used in the short run, Orr says it isn't sustainable because it takes massive amounts of energy and water to produce.
Artificial snow has been a stopgap solution to kind of bridge those gaps, but it's not going to solve everything. So if you don't have enough snow, you can produce it using artificial snow guns. But if you blow that snow out of the gun and it hits the ground and it's too hot for it to stay on the ground, there's nothing really you can do about that.
The lack of snow could also spell economic disaster for those who count on the skiing industry for tax revenue and jobs. Chris Davenport, a professional skier and climate activist from Aspen, agrees climate change is making winter sports a risky business.
It's really difficult to plan for your ski resort business or your apparel business or anyone who depends on the winter if you really have no idea if there's going to be snow or not. It's risky for sponsors, for nations, for teams and athletes if they just don't know what's going to happen.
The next Winter Olympics are scheduled for 2026 in Milan and Cortina, Italy. I'm Mark Richardson.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 1st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Ethan Sandweiss. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mike Clifford, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Mullen, Mary Sherman, Emily Scott, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues with Paul Rowland. At 9, it's Fight the Empire, where host Per Fegring connects history with the latest world events. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views on cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We're hearing more about the Cascade Festival of African Films starting this Friday. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
At 32 years, the Cascade Festival of African Films is a Portland institution. A committee of academics and film buffs selects a handful of the year's best films from across the continent and among the diaspora. Festival coordinator Tracy Francis is on her sixth year with the festival, and she's transitioning back to an in-person festival as safely as possible.
I believe this is my sixth year with the festival. I'm a baby compared to everyone else. Yeah. So we have two staff, and when we have a committee of about 50 volunteers, and a lot of them have been involved for all 32 years. So we have a lot of folks that have been with the festival for a long time, which is wonderful, including some of the founders of the festival who are still very involved.
How do you find the films that you screen to the festival? Is that the committee's responsibility, or are you kind of trawling for particular directors, you know?
It's kind of a combination of things. So I usually kind of hone in on, I narrow down our field to about, 50 or 60 films, and then we have a volunteer screening committee that then watches the films I've narrowed down, and we select from those. And I keep track, of course, of directors I like. We do an open submission call on Film Freeway. In pre-pandemic times, I would go to other film festivals, but last couple of years I've been watching a lot of stuff online and just keeping track of the virtual festivals happening around the world and seeing what cool new films are coming out.
And you had a virtual festival for the past 2 years, I'm assuming, or at least last year.
Last year, yeah. Our 30th, we got right under, that the pandemic was just kind of starting, but it did nothing. It